that. Still have special sauce?
I have about 50 gallons of Big Mac sauce. And as far as pickles, I'm good forever. Let me get your order started. I'd go with the bagel bun if I was you.
Bagel, then.
Albert dropped a fresh basket of fries into hot oil. Then an order of nuggets in a second basket. He punched both timers. He moved with ease to the grill and slapped three patties down. He laid out the bagel, squirted on some sauce, sprinkled onions, placed two pickle chips in the center of the bagel top. He waited and watched Mary trying to cheer Isabella up in the dining area. The little girl was solemn and seemed on the edge of tears. Albert flipped the burgers and settled the burger press in place to speed cooking. The fry timer went off. He lifted the basket, shook it to throw off extra oil, and tossed the fries into the bin. A quick pass with the salt shaker. Then up came the nuggets. Albert enjoyed the balletic moves he had practiced and perfected over the last... how many days had it been? 8? 9? 9 days running the McDonald's.
Cool,
Albert said with quiet satisfaction. Since the incident everyone now referred to as Albert's cat, Albert had stayed in, or at least close to, the McDonald's. There were no supernatural teleporting cats in the McDonald's. He assembled the order onto two trays and carried them out to the only occupied table.
Thanks, Mary said gratefully.
We ran out of our regular promo, Albert said. But I got some toys, you know, little stuff from Ralph's or whatever. So there is a toy in the Happy Meal, just not the regular one.
Isabella pulled a tiny plastic doll with bright pink hair from her bag. She did not smile, but she did hold on to the doll.
So how long can you keep this place open?
Mary asked.
Well, I have lots of burger patties. The day of the phase, there was a delivery truck coming through. You must have seen it plowed into that old house up behind the muffler place, right? Anyway, when I got there, the engine was still running, so the cooling unit was still on. I have my walk-in packed. Plus, I have burgers stashed in freezers all over town.
He nodded in satisfaction.
I have 16,280 patties, including quarter pounders. I'm selling about 250 a day, so I'm good for about 2 months, give or take. Fries will run out sooner.
Then what?
Albert hesitated, like he wasn't sure if he should get into it, but then, glad to have someone to share his worries with, he said,
Look, we can't live forever on the food we have. I mean, okay, we have all the food here, all the food at the grocery store, and a bunch of food in all the different houses, right?
That's a lot of food. Sit with us, Albert.
He was uncomfortable doing so.
It says in the manual we don't sit down with customers. But I guess I could take a break and sit at this next table.
Mary smiled.
You're into this.
Albert nodded.
When the phase comes down, I want the district manager to come here and say, Wow, good job, Albert.
It's more than a good job. You make people think maybe there's some hope, you know?
Thanks, Mary. That's cool of you to say that.
He thought it was the nicest thing anyone had ever said to him, and it gave him a nice glow. Lots of kids just came in and complained that he didn't have exactly what they wanted.
But you're worried about what happens next?
Mary prompted.
There's a lot of food now, but already there are shortages. You almost can't find a candy bar or chips anymore. Sodas will run out before too much longer, and eventually we'll be out of everything.
How long is eventually?
I don't know, but pretty soon people will be fighting over food. We're using food up. We're not growing more food or making or creating new things.
Mary had taken two bites of the Big Mac.
Does Kane know this?
I've told him, but he's got his mind on other things.
This is kind of a major problem,
Mary said. Albert didn't want to talk about sad things, not while someone was enjoying his food. But Mary was the one asking, and as far as Albert was concerned, Mary was a saint just like the ones in the church. He shrugged and said,
I'm just trying to do my thing here.
Can we grow food?
Mary wondered aloud.
I guess that's up to Kane or whoever,
Albert said cautiously. Mary nodded.
You know what, Albert? I don't really care who is running things, but I have to look out for my kids.
And I have this place,
Albert agreed.
And Dara has the hospital,
Mary added.
And Sam used to have the fire station.
Yeah.
It was a weird moment for Albert. He admired Mary. He thought she was the most beautiful person he'd ever known, aside from his mom. And he wanted to trust Mary. But he didn't know for sure that he could. He was troubled by what was going on in Perdido Beach. But what if Mary felt differently? What if she told Drake that Albert was complaining, maybe without even meaning to? Drake could order him to shut down. And Albert didn't know what he would do with himself if he lost the restaurant. The work had kept him from thinking much about what had happened. And for the first time in his life, Albert was an important person. At school, he was just another kid. Now, he was Albert Hillsborough, businessman. All things considered, Albert would want Kane and Drake gone. But the only other person who might step up and run things was off somewhere, a hunted person.
How's the burger?
He asked Mary.
You know what?
She smiled and licked ketchup from her finger.
I think I actually like it better with the bagel bun.
31. 100 hours, 13 minutes. They drove with maddening slowness from Perdido Beach to Coates. Panda at the wheel, even more nervous than usual. Terrified, it seemed to Jack. It was dark, and Panda kept saying he had never driven in the dark. It had taken him 5 fumbling minutes just to find the lights and figure them out. Kane sat beside him, chewing on his thumb, quiet but preoccupied. He had cross-examined Jack repeatedly on the procedure for recording Andrew's big exit. Somehow, what had started out as Kane's brainstorm had become Jack's responsibility. If it worked, then Kane would reclaim it as his own. But if it failed, Jack would no doubt take the blame. Diana, who sat beside Jack, for once had little to say. Jack wondered if she dreaded the return to Coates as much as he did. Jack was wedged in between Diana and Drake. Drake was holding a handgun, an automatic, more gray than black, in his lap. Jack had never seen a gun up close. He had certainly never seen a gun in the hands of a boy he thought was probably crazy. Drake could not leave the gun alone. He kept thumbing the safety on and off. He rolled down the window and aimed it at stop signs as they passed, but did not fire it.
You know how to shoot that thing? Or are you going to shoot yourself in the foot?
Diana finally asked.
He's not going to shoot it,
Kane snapped before Drake could answer.
It's just a prop. We want Andrew to behave. And you know how difficult he can be. The gun keeps people calmed down.
Yeah, I know. It makes me feel really calm,
Diana said.
Shut up, Diana, Drake said.
Diana laughed in her drawly way and fell silent again. Jack was sweating, although it was a cool evening and Kane had the windows down. Jack felt like he might throw up. He'd considered saying he was too sick to go, but he knew Kane wouldn't let him stay home. He'd felt worse and worse all day as he raced to assemble the equipment they would need. He had spent the day with Drake, searching homes for cameras and tripods. Jack had already had enough of Drake Merwin to last him forever. They neared the gate. It was an impressive thing. Two sides of filigreed wrought iron, 20 feet high and hanging from pillars of stone that were even taller. The coat's motto, Ad Augusta per Augusta, was on two gold-tinged plaques that came together when the gates were closed.
"Honk the horn. Whoever's on gate must be asleep," Kane ordered.
Panda tapped the horn. When there was no response, he leaned on it. The sound was flat, swallowed up by the trees.
"Drake," Kane said.
Drake climbed out, gun in hand, and advanced to the gate. He swung it open and stepped through to the stone guardhouse. He emerged a few seconds later and climbed back into the car.
"No one in the guardhouse."
Kane frowned in the rearview mirror.
"That's not like Benno. Benno follows orders."
Benno was the thug Kane had left in charge at Coates. Jack had never liked the boy. No one did. But Kane was right. Benno was the kind of bully who did what the bigger bullies told him to do. He didn't make his own judgments, and he wasn't stupid enough to think he could override Kane's orders.
"Something isn't right," Panda said.
"Everything isn't right, Panda,"
Diana said. Panda pulled through the gate. It was another quarter mile to the school. They drove in silence. Panda pulled the car up to the end of the driveway, to the turnaround in front of the main building. Lights were on in every window. One of the second floor windows had been blown out so that an entire classroom could be clearly seen. Desks were piled against one wall. The chalkboard was cracked and scarred. All the drawings and posters and exhortations that had once adorned the classroom walls were charred, curled by heat. A massive slab of brick and lathe wall lay on the lawn.
"Well, that's not good,"
Diana drawled.
"Who has the power to do that?" Kane demanded angrily.
"The kid we're here to see,"
Diana said.
"Although that's a lot of damage for a 3-bar.
"Benno's lost control up here,"
Drake commented.
"I told you Benno was a wimp."
"Come on,"
Kane said, and stepped out onto gravel, followed by the rest of them.
"Go up the stairs, Panda. Open the door. Let's see what's waiting for us."
"No way,"
Panda said, his voice shaky.
"Coward,"
Kane said. He raised his hands, palms out, and suddenly Panda was flying through the air. He slammed into the door and fell in a heap. Panda rose slowly. Then he fell down again.
"My leg is hurt. I can't move it."
At that moment, the front door opened, smacking Panda where he lay. Light spilled out from inside, and Jack saw half a dozen shapes. Shapes like apes walking on all fours, pushing their way out, crying, howling, terrified. They tumbled down the steps, each carrying a rough-hewn cement block that they dragged as they ran. But of course, Jack knew they weren't carrying the blocks. Their hands were encased in cement. Jack had tried not to think about it. He had tried to put it out of his mind, this crude, cruel solution to the problem of disloyal kids with powers. But since discovering his own power, he had thought of little else. They had discovered early on that the supernatural powers seemed to be focused through the hands. No, Jack corrected himself harshly. They hadn't discovered it. He had discovered it. He had observed it, and he had told Kane about it. And Kane had ordered Drake to do this horrible thing.
"Remember who owns you,"
Diana whispered in Jack's ear.
"Feed us! Feed us! We need food!"
the concrete-blocked victims cried. It was a chorus of weak, desperate voices, so raw with need that Jack panicked. He couldn't be here. He couldn't be with these people. He turned away, but Drake grabbed his shoulder and yanked him forward. No escape. The freaks cried for food. A girl named Taylor, her arms red and raw above the block, face streaked with filth, stinking of her own bodily fluids, collapsed at Jack's feet.
"Jack,"
she croaked.
"They're starving us. Benno was feeding us, but he disappeared. We haven't eaten. Please, Jack."
Jack doubled over and threw up in the gravel.
"Rather overdramatic, Jack,"
Diana remarked. Kane was walking up the steps now, and Drake rushed to catch up. Diana half-lifted Jack and propelled him forward, past the kids with the cinderblock hands. Jack saw Kane silhouetted in the doorway, Drake rushing to move in front, good little dog that he was. There was a boom, like the crack of a supersonic jet going overhead. Drake fell back against Kane. The gun went flying from his hand. Kane kept his footing, but Drake clutched at his ears, on his knees, moaning. Kane reached back over his shoulder with one hand, not even looking back. He spread his fingers, bared his palms. The fallen portion of wall came apart, brick by brick. One by one, as though each brick had sprouted wings, they lifted off and flew. The bricks hurtled past Kane's head and through the open door as fast as machine gun bullets. The door slammed shut. The bricks smashed through. Wood splintered with a sound like a jackhammer. In seconds, the door was a shattered mess. Kane laughed, taunting whoever was on the other side of the door.
"Is that you, Andrew? Is that you, thinking you can fight me?"
Kane advanced, still directing the Gatling gun flow of bricks above his head.
"You've got your mojo working, Andrew," Kane yelled, "but you're still just second best."
Kane stepped through the decimated doorway. Diana, ducking beneath the brick stream, her expression wild with excitement, said,
"Come on, Jack. You don't want to miss the show."
Inside was the grand hallway that Jack knew well. Three stories high, dominated by a massive chandelier. Twin staircases led to the landing on the second floor. The bricks had already hammered one of those staircases to splinters. The noise was like a chainsaw chewing on metal. Andrew, a boy Jack had known as a fairly nice kid, not even really much of a bully until his powers had come, stood shell-shocked, not 10 feet from Kane. There was a wet stain in the crotch of his pants. The barrage of bricks stopped as suddenly as it had begun. Andrew made an abortive move for the second staircase.
"Don't make me destroy that staircase, too," Kane warned. "It would be very inconvenient."
The fight went out of Andrew. He let his hands drop to his sides. He looked like a kid whose mother had just caught him doing something wrong. Guilty. Scared. Looking for a way to bargain.
"Kane! I didn't know it was you, dude. I thought we were, like, you know,
being attacked by a Frederico.
His voice shook. He tried to cover the telltale stain with his hands.
Freddy? What has Frederico got to do with anything?
Man, Benno disappeared, right? And someone had to run things, right? Frederico tried to take over, even though Benno was more my friend than his, and then...
I'll handle Freddy later, Kane interrupted. Who do you think you are, trying to run things, Andrew?
What was I supposed to do, Kane?
Andrew wheedled.
Benno poofed. Frederico was all like, I'm taking over. But me, I was standing up for you, Kane.
The idea had obviously just occurred to Andrew.
That's all I was doing. I was standing up for you. Frederico was like, Kane sucks. Forget Kane. I'm taking over.
Kane turned Andrew out and aimed a furious glare at Jack.
How did we miss Benno's birthday?
Jack had no answer. His insides turned to water. He shrugged, helpless. Then he began to fumble for his PDA, wanting to prove that Benno's birthday was not due yet. Diana said,
Kane, you think maybe sometimes the school records could be wrong? Like maybe some senile school secretary wrote down a 1 instead of a 7 or whatever? Don't blame Jack. You know Jack is too anal to make a mistake with a number.
Kane stared hard at Jack. Then he shrugged.
Yeah, whatever. Besides, we still have Andrew getting ready for his big jump.
Andrew licked his lips, then tried to laugh.
I'm not gonna vacate. I'm not taking the exit. See, Benno was asleep. He had powers, but the dude was asleep. So I don't think if you have powers, you poof. Not if you're awake and you're, you know, ready.
Diana laughed out loud, a jarring sound. Kane flinched. Then he said,
That's an interesting theory, Andrew. We're gonna put it to the test.
What's that mean?
We just wanna watch, Drake said.
Just don't... You're not gonna plaster me, right? I'm still your guy, Kane. I would never use my powers against you. If I knew it was you, I mean.
Diana snapped,
You're letting these freaks starve. I can see why you'd be worried about being plastered.
Hey, we're running out of food,
Andrew whined.
Drake, shoot the creep,
Diana said. Drake just laughed.
I think we'll do this in the dining hall,
Kane said.
Jack, do you have your gear?
Jack jumped 6 inches, startled at being addressed again.
No, no, I have to go back and get it.
Drake, take I and get the stuff,
Kane said.
Diana, take Andrew's hand and lead him to the dining hall.
It was a sound that was almost quaint when the sun was shining, but now, in the dark, the yip-yip howl sent shivers down their spines.
It's just a coyote, Sam said. Don't worry about him.
They could barely see where they were placing their feet, so they moved slowly, tentatively.
Maybe we should have camped back in that gulch, Adelio said.
As soon as we find a fairly flat place to lay out our sleeping bags, I'm all for stopping, Sam said.
Hours before, they had come to a deep, steep-sided gulch, impossible to bypass, and almost impossible to climb. Little Pete had gone into a complete meltdown while being hauled bodily up the far side of the gulch, and they had all been terrified he might do something.
Hawaii, Quinn began saying, as Little Pete howled. Hawaii.
Why you keep saying Hawaii, man?
Adelio had asked him. If he freaks and decides to take us on a Little Pete magical mystery tour, I want it to be Hawaii, not back to Astrid's house.
Adelio thought that over for a while.
I'm down with that. Hawaii, LP. Hawaii.
But Little Pete had not choked anyone, had not teleported anyone, or otherwise violated the original laws of physics. The barrier was farther and farther off to their left, all but invisible in the light of the rising moon. Sam was still determined to follow it, but no longer with any real hope of finding a gate, just because it was the only way he knew to find his way home. Sooner or later, the barrier would curve back around to Perdido Beach. There was a startlingly loud yip, yip, yip.
"Jeez, that was close,"
Adelio said. Sam nodded. "That direction. Maybe we veer off a little, huh?"
"I thought coyotes were nothing,"
Adelio grumbled.
"They are. Normally."
"Tell me you're not thinking about coyotes growing wings,"
Adelio said.
"I think we're getting more sand and less rock," Astrid observed. "Petey hasn't tripped in a while."
"I can't see well enough to be sure," Sam said. "But let's pull up in 5 minutes either way. Everyone start looking for firewood as you go."
"If I can't see the ground, how am I going to see firewood?"
Quinn asked.
"Hey, look," Sam pointed. "There's something over there, I think. Looks like, I don't know, a building or something."
"I can't see a thing," Quinn said.
"It's just darker than the regular darkness. I'm not seeing stars."
They veered toward it. There might be food, or water, or shelter. Suddenly, Sam's feet landed on a springy surface that reminded him of the soft pine needle flooring of the forest. He bent down and felt what could only be grass.
"Guys, hold up."
Sam was cautious about using the flashlights. They had a limited supply of batteries and an unlimited supply of darkness.
"Quinn, give us some light here."
There was no mistaking the green color, even in the harsh white light. Cautiously, Quinn played the light around and illuminated a cabin. Beside it was a windmill. They approached cautiously, the five of them bunched up around the doorway, as Quinn shone the light on a door handle, and Sam touched it, gripped it, and froze. He heard the sound of running, scuffling steps in the darkness behind them.
"Get inside, you idiots!"
A voice, a girl's voice, screamed. Quinn swiveled the light, a rush of motion, something pelting toward him. Other things moving, like a sea of gray in the gloom. The beam bounced from a bounding dog onto the terrified face of a ragged, filthy girl.
"Run! Run!"
she screamed. Sam grabbed the door handle and twisted it. But before he could throw it open, the girl plowed into Sam and bowled him over so that he sprawled onto the wooden floor and gathered a rug as he slid. A dog landed on his chest and bounced off. Quinn shouted in pain and shock. He had lost the light. It was still shining across a planked floor, and he scrambled after it. In the beam, Sam saw Astrid's legs, Adelio falling. There came a chorus of angry canine yipping, and the girl who had run Sam down was fighting to stand up, and a dog was barking and snarling, and there were other snarls, too, as swift bodies came in a rush.
"The door! Get the door!"
the girl screamed. Something was on her, something quick and furious, snarling. Sam lurched to his feet, grabbed the door, and tried to slam it closed, but a furry body was in the way. There was a canine protest, a snarl, and sudden pain in his leg. An iron jaw closed around his knee, bone-crushingly strong. Sam fell against the door, and it closed. He slipped and landed on his butt against the door, and the animal, the wild, snarling thing, had its muzzle in his face. Teeth snapped an inch from his eyes. He shoved his hands outward and encountered rough fur over writhing muscle. There was a terrible, sharp pain in his shoulder, and he knew the beast's jaws had closed on his flesh, and now the animal was shaking him, tearing at his flesh, ripping it, digging deeper. Sam cried out in fear and beat with nerveless fists against the beast. It was futile. The beast shifted its jaws with lightning speed from shoulder to Sam's neck. Blood sprayed down his chest. Sam raised his hands, palms out, but the onslaught was too ferocious. His jugular was pumping his brain dry. His hands were no longer his. His entire body now seemed far away. He spiraled down and down into darkness. A soft, heavy thud, and the iron jaw loosed its hold. Another heavy thud. Sam's eyes rolled up in his head, but before he passed out, he caught a glimpse of the wild, ragged girl standing over him. The girl raised her hands, both together, over her head. All was in slow motion for Sam, and there were sparks in his eyes as the girl brought down something heavy and rectangular and yellow on the coyote's head. 32. 97 hours, 43 minutes. Lana lit one of Hermit Jim's lanterns and surveyed the scene. The cabin was just as she had left it. Only now, there were two dead coyotes, three scared kids, a creepy, staring four-year-old, and one nearly dead boy on the floor. She kicked Nip with her toe. No reflex. He was dead, his brain smashed by a solid gold bar. She'd pounded him again and again until her arms were tired. The other coyote she didn't know well enough to name, but he had died the same way, too intent on his prey to realize his peril. Patrick lay in a corner, abashed, confused, not knowing how to behave. One of the kids, a surfer-looking dude, seemed to mirror that confusion.
"Good boy,"
Lana said, and Patrick thumped his tail weakly on the floor.
"Who are you?"
Lana asked the surfer kid.
"Quinn. My name is Quinn."
"How about you?"
the pretty blonde girl asked. Lana was inclined to dislike her at first sight. She looked like the kind of too-perfect girl who would blow off someone like Lana. On the other hand, she was shielding the strange little boy, cradling him in her arms, so maybe she wasn't all bad. A kid with a round face and dark crew cut knelt over the wounded kid.
"Guys, he's hurt bad."
The blonde scrambled to him. She tore the wounded boy's shirt open. A river of blood ran down his chest.
"Oh, God, no!"
the blonde cried. Lana pushed her aside and laid a hand against the pumping wound.
"He'll live,"
Lana said.
"I'll fix him."
"What do you mean you'll fix him?"
the blonde demanded.
"We need stitches. We need a doctor. Look at how he's bleeding."
Lana said,
"What's your name?"
"Astrid, what does it matter? He's..."
She stopped talking then and leaned in close to see.
"The blood flow is slowing."
"Yeah, I noticed that too,"
Lana said dryly.
"Relax, he'll be fine. In fact..."
She tilted her head to get a better look at him.
"In fact, I'll bet when he's not covered in blood, he's cute. Your boyfriend?"
"That's not what it's about,"
Astrid snapped. Then, in a low voice, like she didn't want the others to hear, she said,
"Kind of.
Well, I know how crazy this sounds, but he'll be fine in a few minutes."
she pulled her hand away to reveal that the jagged wound was already closed. She covered the wound again.
Don't ask me how.
No way.
The crew-cut kid breathed. Outside, the coyote pack yipped madly and thudded against the door. But the latch held firm. Lana wedged the back of a chair under the handle and calculated her next move. The door would not hold forever, but the pack would be aimless, unsure of what to do until pack leader came back from his private hunt.
His name's Sam,
Astrid said.
That's Adelio. This is my brother, Little Pete, and I'm Astrid. And I think you just saved our lives.
Lana nodded. Better. The girl was showing Lana respect.
My name's Lana. And listen, people, the coyotes aren't done with us. We need to make sure that door will hold.
I'm on it, Adelio said. The wounded boy woke with a start. He stared at the dead coyotes. He reached for his neck. He stared at the blood on his hand.
You'll live,
Lana said.
And I'll fix the rest of it. Just let me keep my hand on it.
He seemed dubious. He glanced at Astrid.
She saved our lives,
Astrid said.
And she just closed up a wound that was gushing blood a minute ago.
Sam allowed her to place her hand against his neck.
Who are you?
He asked in a croak of a voice.
Lana. Lana Arwen Lazar,
she said.
Thanks.
No problem. But don't be too grateful. Your life may not stay saved.
He nodded. He listened to the frenzy outside and flinched when one of the coyotes threw himself against the door.
Is that a gold bar Adelio is using as a hammer?
Adelio had broken down the bed and was hammering one of the rails over the door. Lana laughed sardonically.
Yeah, we have a lot of gold. Patrick and me, we're rich.
She moved her hand down his neck to his shoulder.
It works better if you take off your shirt,
she said. He winced in pain.
I don't think I can.
Lana slid her hand under his shirt, feeling the gruesome mess of secondary wounds.
It'll feel better in a few minutes.
How do you do that?
He asked.
There are a lot of weird things going on.
The boy nodded.
Yeah, we noticed. Thanks for saving my life.
You're welcome, but like I said, it may be temporary. They're not really trying to get in yet. When pack leader gets here, that could change. They're strong, you know, and smart.
You're bleeding yourself, he said.
I'll fix that,
she said, almost indifferent.
I've gotten kind of used to being cut up one way or another.
She pressed her blood-covered hand against her leg.
Who is this pack leader?
Sam asked.
He's the head coyote. I tricked him into letting me come here. I hoped I'd be able to get away, or at least have something to eat besides roadkill. Coyotes are smart, but they're still just smart dogs, basically. Are you guys hungry? I am.
Sam nodded. Then he climbed stiffly to his feet, moving like an old man.
As soon as I'm done with my leg, I'll do yours,
Lana said.
We have a pretty good supply of food and plenty of water, at least for a while. The question is whether pack leader will be able to find a way in here.
Astrid said,
You're talking about this coyote like he's a person.
Lana laughed.
Not a person you'd want to hang out with.
Is he just a coyote?
Astrid asked. Lana stared at the girl. Now she could see the intelligence beneath the pretty girl looks.
What do you know about that?
Lana asked cautiously.
I know some animals are changing. We've seen a seagull with talons, and we saw, well, a snake with what looked like
little stub wings.
Lana nodded.
Yeah, I've seen those. Up close. They scare the coyotes half to death, I can tell you that. They can't quite fly, but the rattlers use the wings to get just a little more range than they used to have. They actually saved my butt once, and I saw them kill a coyote just a few hours ago. Pack leader said...
Sid? Adelio echoed.
I'll tell you all about it, but let's eat first. I've had nothing to eat, although I was offered some raw squirrel. Canned pudding, that's what I want. I've been dreaming about it.
She hauled out a can and feverishly worked the can opener. She didn't wait for a dish or spoon, but thrust her hand in and scooped some into her mouth. Then she stood transfixed, overwhelmed by the wonderful sweetness of it. She was crying when she said,
I'm sorry. I've forgotten how to be polite. I'll get you guys your own can.
Sam hobbled over and scooped some pudding of his own, following her lead. I'm way past polite myself, he said, although she could see he was a little appalled by her wolfish behavior. She decided then that she liked him.
Listen, Sam, and everyone, you need to know something so it won't freak you out. Pack leader can speak. I mean, human words. Like smart girl Barbie there was saying, he's some kind of mutant or whatever. I know you think I'm probably crazy.
She had Hermit Jim's tin cup now, and used it to scoop up another helping of wonderful, wonderful pudding. Blondie, Astrid, was opening a can of fruit cocktail.
What do you know about the phase?
Astrid asked. Lana stopped eating and stared at her.
The what?
Astrid shrugged and looked embarrassed.
That's what people are calling it. The Fallout Alley Youth Zone. Phase.
What does that mean?
Have you seen the barrier?
She nodded.
Oh, yeah. I've seen the barrier. I touched the barrier, which, by the way, is not a good idea.
Sam said, as far as we can tell, it goes clear around in a big circle. Or maybe a sphere. We think the center is the power plant. It seems like a 10-mile radius from there, you know, 20 miles across.
Circumference of 62.83 miles, with an area of 314.159 square miles,
Astrid said. 0.159, Quinn echoed from his corner. That's important.
It's basically pi,
Astrid said.
You know, 3.14159265. Okay, I'll stop.
Lana hadn't stopped being hungry. She took a scoop of the fruit cocktail.
Sam, you think the power plant caused it?
Sam shrugged, and then he hesitated, surprised. Lana guessed that he felt no pain in his shoulder.
No one knows. All of a sudden, every single person over the age of 14 disappears, and there's this barrier, and people... animals...
Lana slowly absorbed this new information.
You mean all the adults? They're gone?
Poof, Quinn said. They ditched. They blinked out. They vacated. They took the off-ramp. They cut a hole. They emigrated. Adults and teenagers. Nothing left but kids. I've done all I can do to strengthen the door, Adelio announced. But all I have is nails. Someone can break it in eventually.
Maybe they didn't all ditch,
Lana said.
Maybe we did.
Astrid said,
That's definitely one of the possibilities, not that it makes any real difference. It's effectively the same thing.
So the blonde was definitely a brain. Lana wondered about her little brother. He was awfully quiet for a little kid.
My grandfather disappeared while he was driving the truck,
Lana said, recalling that terrible day.
The truck crashed, and I was dying. I mean, bones sticking out,
gangrene. Then it was like I could just heal. My dog. Myself. And I don't know why.
From beyond the wooden door came a sudden chorus of excited yelps.
"Pack leader's here,"
Lana said. She crossed to the sink and picked up Hermit Jim's kitchen knife. She turned to Sam, her expression fierce.
"I'll stab him in his heart if he comes in here."
Sam and Adelio both drew their knives. From outside the door, just inches away, came the strangled, snarling, high-pitched voice.
"Human, come out!"
"No!"
Lana yelled.
"Human, come out!"
Lana said,
"Not by the hair of my chinny-chin-chin!"
Astrid smiled.
"Nice,"
she whispered.
"Human, come out! Human teach, pack leader! Human say!"
"Lesson number one, you filthy, ugly, nasty, mangy animal! Never trust a human!"
That resulted in a protracted silence.
"The darkness,"
pack leader growled. Lana felt fear contract her heart.
"Go ahead. Go tell your master in the mine all about it."
She started to say that she wasn't afraid of the darkness, but those words would have sounded false.
"What's this about a mine?" Sam asked.
"Nothing."
"Then why is that coyote out there talking about it? What's this darkness thing?"
Lana shook her head.
"I don't know. They took me there. It's an old gold mine. That's all."
Sam said,
"Look, you saved our lives, but we still want to know what's going on."
Lana twined her fingers together around the knife hilt to keep herself from shaking.
"I don't know what's going on, Sam. There's something down in that mine. That's all I know. The coyotes listen to it. They're scared of it, and they do what it says."
"Did you see it?"
"I don't know. I don't remember. I don't really want to remember."
There was a loud thump at the door, and it rattled on its hinges.
"Adelio, let's find some more nails," Sam said.
The dining hall of Coates Academy had always seemed like a strange, unfriendly place to Jack. In terms of design and decor, it was an attempt to be airy and colorful. The windows were tall, the ceiling lofty. The doors were high arches decorated with bright, ornamental Spanish tiles. The long, heavy, dark wood tables of Jack's first year at Coates, tables that had accommodated 60 students each, had just this last year been replaced by 24 smaller, less formal, round tables decorated with papier-mâché centerpieces made by students. At the farthest end of the dining hall, a mosaic had been created of individually painted construction paper squares. The theme was "Forward Together." The squares had been arranged to form a giant arrow pointing from the floor to the ceiling. But the more they tried to brighten the room, the less friendly it seemed to grow, as if the little touches of color and whimsy just accented the crushing size, age, and irreducible formality of the room. Panda, his leg not broken but badly sprained, slumped into a chair and looked mournful and resentful. Diana stood to one side, not liking what she was about to witness, and not keeping that feeling a secret. "Get up on the table, Andrew," Kane ordered, pointing to one of the large round tables in front of the arrow mosaic.
"What do you mean, get up on the table?"
Andrew demanded. Some kids poked their heads into the dining hall. Drake said, "Shoo," and they disappeared.
"Andrew, you can climb up on the table or I can levitate you up there," Kane said.
"Get up, moron,"
Drake snapped. Andrew climbed onto a chair, then onto the table.
I don't see what...
Tie him up. Computer Jack, start setting up.
Drake pulled rope from the bag he'd retrieved from the car. He tied one end around a table leg, measured out about 6 feet, cut the rope, then tied the end around Andrew's leg.
Man, what is this? Andrew said. What are you doing?
It's an experiment, Andrew.
Jack began setting up lights and tripods for cameras.
This is bogus, man. This isn't right, Kane. It's not right.
Andrew, you're lucky I'm giving you a chance to survive the big blink, Kane said. Now stop sniveling.
Drake tied Andrew's second leg and then hopped onto the table to tie Andrew's hands firmly behind him.
Dude, I need my hands free for the power.
Drake looked at Kane, who nodded. Drake untied Andrew's hands and glanced at the chandelier above. He tossed the rope end up over the chandelier, an ornate, heavy iron thing that Coates' kids joked was the 10th Nazgul. Drake cinched the rope up around Andrew's chest, pulled it up under his armpits, and hauled him up till his feet barely touched the tabletop.
Make sure his hands can't aim in this direction, Kane said. I don't want that shockwave thing of his knocking cameras over.
So Drake suspended each hand by the wrist, leaving Andrew looking like a boy who was trying to surrender. Jack watched the LED viewfinder of one of the cameras. Andrew would still be able to move out of frame by swaying one way or the other. Jack didn't want to say anything. He felt sorry for Andrew. But if the video got messed up...
He could still move left or right a little.
Drake then ran ropes from Andrew's neck, four of them leading to tables on four sides. Andrew could move no more than a foot in any direction.
What's the time, Jack? Kane asked.
Jack checked his PDA.
10 minutes.
Jack busied himself with the cameras, four of them on tripods, three video, and one a motorized still camera. He had two lights on poles shining down on Andrew. Andrew was lit up like he was some kind of movie star.
I don't want to die, Andrew said.
Me neither, Kane agreed. That's why I really hope you can beat the poof.
I would be like... the first, huh?
Andrew said. He sniffed. Tears were starting to flow.
First and only, Kane said.
This isn't fair,
Andrew said. Jack adjusted the lens to encompass Andrew's entire body.
5 minutes,
Jack said.
I'm gonna go ahead and start the video running.
Do what you have to do, Jack. Don't announce it, Kane said.
Can't you help me out, Kane?
Andrew pleaded.
You're a four bar. Maybe you and me, if we both used our power at the same time, right?
No one answered him.
I'm scared, okay?
Andrew moaned, and now the tears were flowing freely.
I don't know what's gonna happen.
Maybe you wake up outside the phase,
Panda said, speaking for the first time.
Maybe you wake up in hell,
Diana said,
where you belong.
I should pray,
Andrew said.
God forgive me for being a creep who starves people,
Diana suggested.
1 minute,
Jack said softly. He was nervous about when to start the still camera. No one figured Andrew's birth certificate was exact to the minute. Benno's had been off by weeks. He could disappear early.
Jesus, forgive me for all the bad stuff I did. And take me to my mom. I miss her so bad. Please let me live. I'm just a kid, so let me live, okay? In Jesus' name, amen.
Jack switched on the still camera.
10 seconds.
The room erupted with a sonic explosion from Andrew's upraised hands. Waves of shattering sound began to crack the plaster ceiling. Jack covered his ears and stared in fascination and horror.
"Time!"
Jack remembered to yell over the barrage of noise. Chunks of plaster were falling from the ceiling like hail. The bulbs in the chandelier all shattered, sending down a snowfall of glass dust.
"Plus 10!"
Jack yelled. Andrew was still there, hands high, crying, sobbing, beginning to hope, maybe, beginning to hope.
"Plus 20!"
Jack said.
"Keep it up, Andrew!"
Kane yelled. He was on his feet now, eager, hoping it was true that the blink could be beaten. The ceiling was cracking more deeply, and Jack wondered if it would fall. The sonic blast ended. Andrew stood, exhausted, but still there, still standing.
"Oh, God,"
he said.
"Oh, thank—"
And he was gone. The ropes fell, suddenly released. No one said a word. Jack pushed rewind on one of his high-speed video cameras. He backed it up 10 seconds. Then he hit play and watched it on the tiny LCD screen, frame by frame.
"Well," Diana was saying, "so much for the theory that you don't ditch if you have powers."
"He stopped blasting," Kane said. "Then he blinked out."
"He stopped blasting, and then 10 seconds later he ditched," Diana said. "Birth certificate records are never going to be 100% precisely accurate. Some nurse writes down the time. Maybe it's 5 minutes one way or the other. Some are probably off by a half hour."
"Did you get anything, Jack?" Kane asked. He sounded disheartened. Jack was advancing frame by frame. He saw Andrew projecting sonic blasts. He saw him stop, worn out from the effort. He saw the nervous half-smile, the moment when he opened his mouth, each syllable, and then...
"We need to play this on a bigger monitor," Jack said.
They carried the cameras to the computer center and left the tripods and lights behind. There, they found a 26-inch monitor, crystal clear. Jack didn't waste time downloading, just hooked up the leads and started playing. Kane, Drake, and Diana crowded around over his shoulder, eager faces lit with blue light. Panda limped over to a chair and slumped down.
"Look," Jack explained, "right here, watch what happens."
He advanced the file frame by frame.
"What is that?"
Diana asked.
"He's smiling, see?"
Jack said.
"And he's looking at something. And what's weird is that it's not possible because this frame is like a 30th of a second, but he's got time to go from this expression..."
He backed it up a frame.
"To this expression. To this. See here where he's moved his head again? And right here, the ropes are slipping away. His hands are free. Move it ahead just 3 frames, and he's completely gone."
"What does it mean, Jack?"
Kane almost implored.
"Let me look at the other cameras."
Jack stalled. Of the 2 remaining video cameras, only one had a shot of the actual moment. This one, too, showed a blurry picture of Andrew moving in a sudden jerk from one posture to another. In this one, too, the ropes were loose and his arms were extended.
"He's reaching out for a hug,"
Diana said. The still camera was unlikely to yield anything useful, Jack knew, but he attached it and fast-forwarded to the right time signature. When the photo loaded up, there was a collective gasp. Andrew was clearly visible, smiling, happy, transformed, with arms outstretched. The thing he was reaching toward looked like a light flare, a reflection of something, except that it was an almost fluorescent green, and all the lights had been white.
"Zoom in on that green blob," Kane said.
"It's a depth of field problem,"
Jack said.
"Let me try to enhance it."
It took a few seconds for the image to focus into the green cloud. It took several layers of enhancement before they could see what looked like a hole ringed by needle-sharp teeth.
"What is that thing?"
Drake wondered aloud.
"It looks like... I don't know,"
Jack said.
"But it doesn't look like something you'd be reaching out for."
"He was seeing something different,"
Diana said.
"It altered time somehow, accelerated Andrew's time,"
Jack said, thinking out loud.
"So, for Andrew, it was all lasting a lot longer than it was for us. For him, it may have been 10 seconds, or even 10 minutes, although for us it was less than the blink of an eye. It was just sheer luck we caught any of it."
Kane surprised him then, and actually patted him on the back.
"Don't sell yourself short, Jack."
Diana said,
"He didn't just poof. He saw something. He reached out to it. That green thing, what looks like some kind of a monster to us, must have looked like something else to Andrew."
"What, though?"
"Whatever he wanted it to be,"
Diana said.
"Whatever he wanted so badly at that moment that he reached for it. If I had to guess, I'd say Andrew saw his mommy."
Drake spoke for the first time in a while.
"So this big blink thing isn't just something that happens."
"No, there is deception involved," Kane said. "A trick. A lie.
A seduction,"
Diana said.
"Like one of those carnivorous plants that attracts the bug with perfume and bright colors, and then..."
She closed her hand around an imaginary bug. Kane seemed mesmerized by the frozen image. In a dreamy voice, he said,
"Is it possible to say no? That's the question. Can we say no to the bright flower? Can we say no and survive?"
"Okay, I get the mommy thing. But I got another question,"
Drake said harshly.
"What's that thing with the teeth?"
33. 88 hours, 24 minutes. All through the night, the coyotes slammed against the door, trying to break it down. But Sam and Quinn and Adelio had stripped the cabin of everything that could be used to strengthen the door, and it would hold. Sam was confident of that. For a while, at least.
"They're locked out," Sam said.
"And we're locked in,"
Lana agreed.
"Can you do it?"
Astrid asked Sam.
"I don't know," Sam admitted. "I guess. But I have to go out there to do it. If it works, okay. Maybe. If it doesn't..."
"More pudding, anyone?" Quinn, trying to lighten the mood.
"Better to stay in here,"
Astrid opined.
"They'll have to come through the door. That means one or two at a time. Wouldn't that be easier, Sam?"
"Yeah, it'll be a party."
He held out his tin cup. "Quinn, pudding me." After several long hours, the coyotes tired of slamming against the door. The trapped kids grabbed a few hours of sleep each, two at a time, always making sure two were awake. The sky began to lighten to pearl gray, not enough to see clearly, but enough for Adelio to find a knothole that gave him a dim view of the front yard.
"There's got to be maybe 100 of them out there," he reported.
Lana got up from repairing her clothing with a needle and thread and looked for herself.
"That's more than one pack,"
she said.
You can tell that?